Welcome to the Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg McDonough. Each week, we hear real-time stories from athletes and CEOs on how to maximize performance through an endurance mindset. Let's get started. Well, welcome to the Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg McDonough. Today's guest is a running, cycling, and triathlon participant who actively helps deliver great experiences on race days. He has announced and commentated 9 national championships in the U.S. and Canada, including track cycling, road cycling, track and field, road running, cross country, and triathlon. Please welcome the professional live race event announcer, presenter, sports commentator, and MC, Steve Fleck. Steve, welcome to the show.
Greg, wow, that introduction was over the top. I really appreciate it. When you string it all together like that, it sounds really impressive, actually. So thank you.
It is very impressive. And we were just chatting about being on the opposite sides of the microphone. So this is a fun episode for us. So Steve, we love chatting about endurance and the endurance mindset. And I'd love to know, how has your endurance mindset impacted your life unexpectedly?
I think it's because I've been a lifelong endurance sports athlete. I mean, I was an athlete first before I started doing this. Then I worked in various roles in the sporting goods business, mostly in sales and marketing roles, and now really selling and marketing, you know, myself. And I think the connection for me is to business anyways, is that sort of endurance mindset is, and I go back a while, I'm kind of going all over the map here, but it celebrated some anniversary recently. There is no finish line, the famous Nike tagline. It was the first ad that Nike ever did back in the early days, that Phil Knight and the team did back in the early days, that didn't talk about the shoes. They'd always talked about the technical features of the shoes, and that there is no finish line ad. It's a picture of a lone runner running along a road, and then some copy underneath. But the tagline is, there is no finish line. And when you're in business for yourself, that's what it is. There really is no finish line. You just keep going, or you're working in a sales role. Yeah, you might get your numbers and your bonus and whatnot, but ultimately you need to get back out there and keep making things happen on behalf of the company that you're representing, or in this case, you know, yourself. So the big crossover for me, Greg, has always been the fact, as an endurance sports athlete, we're always out there. There is no finish line. We just keep going. We might cross one finish line, but then we're just getting ready to go across the next finish line. And I didn't really realize that, I think, fully until I got into work for myself and just marketing and selling myself and you know, just keep going. There's a downside to that. We might get to that. But the fundamental part about it is, you just keep going, and one finish line just leads hopefully to another.
You know, it's really well said. And I always think when I'm racing and I'm approaching the finish line of a race, that it's truly, to your point, the starting line of the next race, right? It's less about accomplishing that finish line, and it's more about, okay, what's next? What's the next goal? What's the next achievement? Steve, I'd love to dig in a little bit deeper on your transition between sort of working for somebody else and then working for yourself. What else has come through, and what else have you realized sort of in those two different environments?
Well, I'll go back to working for myself and being, you know, self-employed, or the sexier word, sort of an entrepreneur. That for me happened 2014. So I was working for one of the online event registration companies in the endurance sports space, a Canadian startup that was doing quite well. We pretty much owned the online event registration market in Canada. And they were abruptly sold to a US-based interest. There's a long backstory to that. I won't bore you with all the details. But the impact for me was, myself and a bunch of other people got abruptly sort of let go, you know, from the company. And that had happened to me. That was the second time in my sort of sales career that had happened, where things had conspired sort of behind the scenes that had really no impact, or sort of I had really no responsibility for, but I was, you know, part of the casualties and the carnage of what was going on behind the scenes with the company. So I had started doing, on the side, as sort of a side hustle and a side gig, race and event announcing. So that had started for me around 2010, 2011, and I was already doing it. And an important business mentor of mine I was out for lunch with him. We were sort of brainstorming, talking about what I was going to do. I had just shared with him that I'd been abruptly let go. And he said, Steve, well, you should really blow that up. And you should think about maybe doing that full time because you're really good at it and you could have a tremendous impact on it. And it sounds like you really love doing that. It's a passion of yours. So he made me an offer and he says, look, I'll give you some work for the next 6 to 8 months. I'll pay you a little bit. And you just go about, you know, building up your race and event announcing and sports presentation business. And that's what I did. And I, you know, I did some lead generation business development work for him sort of on the side while I was developing my own business. And then I, you know, by the end of that year, I had a good book of business on the race and event announcing side to go forward and be confident. But without that assistance, Greg, I don't think I would have done that. I'm forever grateful to that gentleman because I had always been employed. And it's really, really difficult if you're always an employee your whole life and getting a regular paycheck, even in a sales role. You know, you've got that guaranteed salary coming in no matter what. Even if you don't get your numbers, you're still going to get that. You might not last that long in the role, but you're still getting a paycheck every 2 weeks. And so it was really intimidating for me to step, you know, out of the airplane kind of with a parachute, not with a parachute, but without that assistance from that kind gentleman, that business mentor of mine, I don't think I would have done what I did. So that was the starting point. And then it just rolled from there. And once you sort of build up some momentum, you know, in a book of business, you know, it just keeps going. It's not easy. This past year, like 23 to 24 has been a bit of a bear. I can possibly get into that in more detail later. But that was the initial push for me and the initial assistance and the hand up and the hand, not really a handout, but a hand up for me to get going.
You know, my story is similar a bit with my grandmother. And I remember chatting with her many, many years ago, thinking about leaving a big financial services firm where it was pretty cushy. And I got my cube and my cubicle and like life was pretty good. And she was the same. Like she gave me a little bit of financial support and really pushed me out of the nest and, you know, did it on my feet and still trying to figure it out as an entrepreneur. But it's definitely a journey. Steve, going back a little bit further, when did you realize that sports announcing, event announcing, commentating was your thing, your passion?
Well, the original catalytic event or moment was actually back when I was in university. I got an opportunity to host my own radio show when I was a student at the University of Guelph. Guelph's a university town, city about an hour to the west, southwest of Toronto. And while I was doing my undergrad there, I got an opportunity to host my own radio show. I didn't realize it at the time, but that was the skill set. I was playing music, but then you had to fill between records that you were playing. You had to ad lib a little bit back and forth with the news person, you know, when they came on. It was a 2-hour show and there was news on the half hours. And then I played music, in between. And as I said, ad lib sort of between songs that I was playing. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that's exactly the skill set you need as an announcer, as an MC, as a sports presentation person, as a commentator. There's scripted stuff that you're working from, but you also have to have the ability, literally on demand, to fill time and space with something, some kind of content. And that was the training, the 3 years of doing that, I didn't realize at the time, that really went forward. The next moment was at Ironman Canada, the triathlon, the famous triathlon in Penticton. The legendary announcer there, Steve King, said to me, would you like to help out with the announcing? I was working for Segoy at the time, the apparel manufacturing company in Vancouver, and we were a sponsor of the race. And on race day, my sort of sponsor duties were kind of done. And Steve asked me, I'd raced at Ironman Canada a number of times, 6 times in total. And I knew Steve really well. He was a good friend of mine. And he said, I always need some help on the microphone. Would you like to help out? So Steve gave me the mic. I worked side by side with him. And that was early days of mobile mics. So when the race winner came across the finish line, Peter Reed, won Ironman Canada. I can't remember what year this was. This was circa 2000, 2001, something like that. And Peter Reed came in and across the finish line, and Steve told me, he said, I'll hold the Ford here up on the stand. I want you go down and interview Peter Reed. Like, this is all on demand kind of stuff, right? So I'm just going, okay, sure, no problem. There's like 10,000 people there, and then I'm interviewing Peter Reed live, you know, in front of 10,000 people at the finish line. No script, nothing. But you're in the moment, you're asking questions, you're back and forth with an important, you know, personality, and you're kind of in the flow. And it just sort of built from there. I did it on and off for a few years, but then I got to that point in 2013, 2014, where I had mentioned previously that it literally became sort of my full-time gig.
So I have to ask you, what was your first question to Peter?
It's always generic. I can't remember exactly, but you want these interviews to be really short and snappy, not like you and I are talking here, sort of long discourse kind of answers. It's the classic, how does it feel to win Ironman Canada for the first time? Or, you know, some canned generic question for that. And there's good interviewees and there's not so good interviewees. I know Peter, he's a good friend of mine, and Pete's somewhat reserved in terms of the response. So I knew I was not going to get a lot back from him. Whereas some, you know, you'll ask that question for some, Lionel Sanders, for example. I mean, you ask Lionel Sanders that same question and Lionel will go on like on this massive discourse about, what it's like. So you need to be careful about what you ask people, because depending on who that is, and you sort of develop this subconscious of your interviewees, you know, over time, because those public interviews like that need to be somewhat short and punchy. You don't want them to go on for 10 minutes. You literally want a 90 second to 2 minute tops hit, you know, with the winner of the race. And so the questions become very important. You either make them so that you'll get a bit out of a more reserved, you know, athlete like a Peter Reed, or to a Lionel Sanders, you're going to get a short hit from him, because otherwise Lionel will just go on for 10 or 15 minutes, and that's what you don't want.
You know, it leads me to think about preparation. And as I, you know, would prepare for an endurance race, for an Ironman race or a long run, there's, you know, weeks and weeks of sort of prep work that we do beforehand. Take us through what you do leading up to a big race that you're announcing or commentating.
It varies, because there's such a range, Greg, in terms of what I do. I mean, there's everything from family fun runs where I literally show up and for 3 or 4 hours, I am essentially a carnival barker and a circus clown. I just did one of those on Sunday. Last Sunday, it was a 10K not too far from Toronto. There was about, I think, 1,000 people in it. And it's just calling people's names out at the finish, interview a few of the sponsors at the start line, intro the person who's, you know, singing the national anthem. It's fairly standard stuff. Those kinds of events for me personally require a very little preparation. I've done so many of them now; it literally is a routine that you go through. I'm not trying to make light of it, but that's essentially, you know, what it is. The larger events, you know, if I was working, say, at an Ironman Canada or a big city marathon where there's an elite and a pro field, you know, that kind of thing, I will spend some time sort of researching the people who are, you know, potentially going to win the race, who I might be interviewing afterwards. So you do have that background knowledge, you know, of the athlete, so that you can be that educated person, you know, asking the questions. The commentary requires even more of a deep dive into stats, data, information. I'm right now in the middle of commentating for Runner Space, a whole series of NCAA track and field meets. I started with the indoor season and we've transitioned right to the outdoor season. And I'm over this next weekend, I'm announcing the Chandler Rotary invite down in Chandler, Arizona. And all that work now is remote. So I'm actually sitting right here in my home studio. The event is in Chandler, Arizona. My producer at Runner Space is in Eugene, Oregon. It's the wonders of modern technology tie this all together. It's kind of crazy. But those sorts of events require very specific research. And I'm plowing through, you know, high school performance lists, trying to find out who the top people are. Because I think there is an expectation when it's broadcast or it's live stream that you know as much as you can about the subject matter and the athletes that you're talking about. I don't know all of them. I mean, I was just researching the 200 meter list before we got on, and there's like 75 kids entered in the girls 200 meters. I can't know all of them, but the performance charts are, you know, I can look at the top 5 or 10, get some names. There are data sites that I can go to. I can dig up, you know, she ran this time. She's the former, you know, Illinois state champion, et cetera, et cetera. Just so you've got those little hits of information. And I make little notes on my paper, sheets of paper that I have that are the heat sheets. Then the other thing is the, you know, live announcing it at the larger, more sophisticated, you know, national championships. That's a pretty much elite field only, or the world championships. I've been lucky to announce it 2 para track cycling world championships in the UCI. Track cycling championships themselves last summer. Again, that requires a huge deep dive into the data, who's who in the zoo, you know, who are the top athletes. I'm announcing in a couple of weeks at the Pan Am track cycling championships in Los Angeles. I'll be live on site for that. And I'm already starting to look over sort of world ranking lists for the top track cyclists in the world, and particularly in North America and South America, so that I'll have some familiarity, you know, when I get there. It varies from, you know, organization to organization. Sometimes I show up and everything's there for me. All the bios, all the information, all the details, you know, about the athletes. But some, you know, you show up and it's nothing. Like, there's an expectation that I've done all the homework and done all the work. So you never know what you're going to get. You have to start asking questions of people well in advance, so you're not scrambling at the last minute, 24 hours before it starts, to get all that information. So I know that for the Pan Am Track Cycling Championships, I'll most likely be responsible for having all that information organized for myself. So I'm taking the time to start well in advance to do that. Other, you know, events that I show up, as I mentioned, it's all there for me. And they've told me that. They said, no, Steve, don't worry. We've got the scripts. We got the bios. It's all good. You just show up. We just want your voice.
I'm curious, Steve, has it gotten to a point that you could predict performance? Like, you get to an event, you know the athletes, you kind of see them warming up, getting ready. Is there sort of a gut feel of like, oh, she's on her game today, I can tell, or he's not really in it? Any sort of intuition been developed over the years?
Not really. I'm a big fan in letting the athletes, you know, race the race and let them tell the story. I'm just there to animate it. You know, as an announcer, as a commentator, we always like to predict and prognosticate. And that's what we do. That, you know, that adds a little bit of, you know, color and flavor, you know, before the starting gun goes off. But once the gun goes off, it's up to the athletes. And they're the ones ultimately that tell the story. And I'm totally happy to be proven wrong. You know, that the top seed who had the best time in the women's 800, and it was 5 or 6 seconds faster than the next seed. And you're thinking, well, if she's got a seed that's 5 or 6 seconds next than anyone else in the 800, most likely she's going to win. And then you see her on the start line, and you know, it she looks really serious, and she looks like she could be a contender, but that she ends up 5th or 6th. So, you know, bad day, not really into it, wrong time of the season. You know, maybe, you know, this is just a training race. They have higher priorities later on, you know, in the year. There's all kinds of factors that go into sort of performance, you know, on the day of. But ultimately, that's the great thing about sport, is it should be a bit of an unknown, you know, and an unpredictable nature. And we can predict and prognosticate all we want, but ultimately the athletes have the final say.
That's really insightful. Thank you. Slightly different question, but kind of on the same topic. Have you noticed certain habits that these athletes, the true elite athletes, are doing day in and day out from a training and mindset perspective?
The biggest thing that I've seen, the most consistent thing, is the really, really good ones. So these are the world-class athletes, the national champions, in some cases Olympic or world champions that I've interacted with, that I've talked to, that I've gotten to know. Is that for them, and this is a mindset I think that we all need to know, and this is adaptive. This is adaptive to your career, your life, your personal relationships. is that it is a journey for them. Yes, there's ups and downs. Yes, there's, you know, there's gold medals. Yes, there's world championships. Yes, there's world records. But there's a lot of other times when it doesn't go that way for them, that, you know, it was a disaster, or there's an injury, or the race strategy didn't go to their plan, or whatever it is. But the mindset for them is that they are on some kind of a journey, you know, from start to finish, and they're immersed in that journey and they enjoy the journey. And it's a lesson that I think I learned after I was a high performance and elite level athlete myself. I was too wrapped up in, you know, win, lose, performance, have to perform on the day of, and if it doesn't happen, you're crushed. Whereas the mindset for those truly elite performers is that it's all about the journey. It sounds like a cliche, but I think if you adopt that kind of a mentality with all the ups and downs we have to experience in life at the micro and the macro level, I think that's a great attitude to have.
You know, it reminds me of an interview I had with a Paralympic 50 meter sprint swimmer. And he was talking about, and he's preparing for Paris, and he's talking about the timing just has to be perfect. Like, you have to be peaking that race on that day in order to get, and that race is so short that all these things have to come together. And so to your point, he looks at it as a journey. It's not just when I'm on the starting block in Paris, it's what am I doing for the next 3 to 5 years? And this is a stepping stone for that longer term goal. You mentioned disaster, right? And we have those in our journeys. I have to ask you, Steve, what has been sort of that awkward, disastrous moment that you've had that kind of makes you palm sweat a little bit over your history of announcing and commentating? Is there one specific story that I can't believe I did X?
Well, there's the micro where you know you've made a mistake, okay? And when you're live, because most of the stuff I do, the higher level stuff I do, either live announcing or live commentary is live. And you know you've made a mistake, but you can't change it. Like, you've called the wrong person in the wrong lane or whatever. And all you can do in the moment is correct it. And yeah, it there is that psychological reaction. Your palms actually get kind of sweaty. You're going, oh my God, I was on a live microphone and I made a massive blunder. But, you know, we're all human and we all make mistakes. So those would be the ones sort of in the micro. And the other thing is, when you're live, you're often in this flow state where if someone came back to me and asked what I said like 2 minutes ago, I might not even know like what I said. Like, you're so like focused on like what is happening, calling the action, you know, at the finish line, calling the action, you know, in a short, you know, 200 meter race, you know, on the track. Those sprint events are really interesting in that you kind of almost have to think about what you're going to say before the gun goes off. Because if you try to do it and think about, like, you know, who's who, the favorites, this, that, and the next thing, the race will be over and you're still stumbling over your words. So you almost have to be prepared to say something like really off the top. And that's often where you do make, you know, the odd mistake and your palms do get a little sort of sweaty. The other thing is more the sort of the macro disaster, and not really disaster, but, you know, this past year for me, I hinted at it before, like I had two record years of the work that I do, volume, prestige of events, et cetera, et cetera. And like going from 23 to 24 has been a real challenge. And it's just, it hasn't been, you know, mistakes that I've made. I think it's just, you know, I need to sort of correct a few things on the business side that I do. You're a big business person, Greg, and I pretty much everything that I had done to date had been literally done on a verbal agreement and a handshake. And so, big lesson learned. Make sure you have a written contract in place, because if you don't, then there's nothing really to go back on. So, you know, that was a big mistake I made with a couple of events last year going forward, you know, from last year to this year, and, you know, lesson learned. And, you know, just going forward now, I have a drafted contract that everyone from even that small fun run 10K that I did last weekend to the bigger, more prestigious events that I will do later on this year, you know, everyone's getting a contract. So at least we have on digital paper, like some form of agreement that this is what's going to happen. This is the business deal we have in place. I mean, it may be, you know, worthless when we ever get to a court, but we hope that never happens. But at least I have some peace of mind that this is what we've agreed to.
It's a great lesson learned there for sure for us fellow entrepreneurs and business owners. It gets very easy just to go and do the work and expect to get paid or get whatever the return is. But without a written contract or an agreement or some sort of understanding, we can open ourselves up to that exposure. Steve, you mentioned the flow state. Is there anything that you do to get into that flow state during a race or during an event? Or does it come naturally just with the excitement of race day?
I think it's just natural and organic. There's no sort of put ons here. I don't put on a different hat. Each of the different buckets of things that I work is a little bit different. As I said, that classic, you know, 10K or half marathon, mass participation race. As I said, I'm part carnival barker, circus clown. There's a few elites that are really serious about, you know, their performance, but after that, everyone's there to just have a great time. And I'm part of the delivery, like of that great time on behalf of the event, you know, at the finish line. The connection is that is a place and a space of high emotion, you know, for people. Everyone, you know, has their own story, their own journey that they've been on to get to that start line and get to that finish line. But I'm there to animate it for them and be there, you know, for them. So I am in that kind of flow state, and I'm seeing their names come up on, you know, the timing computer that I have. And I'm looking at them coming across, looking what they're wearing, if they're wearing some, you know, funny shirt or something, or some club that I'm familiar with. I'm calling out the club. This is the culmination of years and years and years of doing this. And that's how I add value. And the most important thing I'm doing is connecting on behalf of the race and the event and the sponsors, you know, with that person one-on-one, you know, at the finish line. Now, sometimes that's really challenging. I mean, if it's a 5K or 10K and there's 10,000 people in it, I mean, you've seen those events. It's a river of people coming across the finish line. So you can't really do that one-on-one connection with everyone. But, you know, you get towards the back of the field and they start to thin out a little bit, then you can have more time to, you know, connect one-on-one with people. So that's one bucket. And then the other one is that more sophisticated, more professional, you know, kind of work where I've done a ton of research. I know this race field. I know each of the favorites who potentially could win this. You know, if there's an upstart coming up and winning it, you talk about that. But because you've done the work and the research ahead of time, you can craft the story kind of in the flow of the moment and then deliver it, you know, to the viewer, you know, or the listener. I think the key is doing that little or a lot of research, you know, to know the field. I mean, with these massive high school meets, I have limited time to do it. But when it's an elite field and you know the athletes inherently, like if I'm calling the Canadian, you know, track and field championships or the U.S. cycling championships, I mean, you know who these people are. And it's kind of embedded, you know, up here in the brain. So you know if it's a great performance for them or it's, you know, they're off par, you know, somehow. So, but it, again, you're using all of those tools at your disposal, the data that you're getting, what's up here in your head, to craft a story, like literally in the flow of the moment, because that's just the nature of the beast. It's the nature of the job. There, other than like sponsor readouts, there is no real script that I'm working off. As I said before, the athletes are the ones that are creating the story live in front of you.
You know, as an athlete, I absolutely feel a connection with the race that I'm in if the commentator is announcing my name as I come across the finish line. In fact, when I'm in the finisher chute, I try to position myself in a way that I'm not next to somebody or right behind them, just so that I can hear the, you know, Greg McDonough from such and such place. You know, it does provide that special little touch after, you know, a long, long day on race day. Just slightly different question in there. How much does humor come in to your commentating, your announcing? How do you measure what's too, not too funny, what's funny enough, what's crossing the line? Give us a little insight on that.
Yeah, crossing the line, it's kind of tricky in this day and age with political correctness. So you try to err on the side of conservatism with the humor. I've sort of developed this sort of breaker sort of in my brain. You'll see something and you're going, should I commentate on that? Or should I talk about that? Should I mention it? You know, if they're wearing funny colored socks, you know, it's kind of a safe, that's a safe place to go. Hey, look at those, you know, crazy socks. Where did you get those? You know, like stuff like that. That's pretty safe. But there are definitely in this day and age sort of no-go zones that, you just don't go. Body size and shape is a big one. Like just do not, just men or women, do not go there. And, muscularity and stuff like this, when we're talking sort of from the more serious, you know, live commentary now, you have this break in the back of your brain, you know, almost in that flow state, that's also guarding like what you're saying. I've been really lucky. I think in the 10 years I've been doing this, I think I've only been called out once for making some kind of inappropriate, you know, comment. And it was very minor, like in the situation as it went back. But I admitted it. I didn't defend, you know, what I'd said. I said, look, you know, we get carried away. You know, we make these comments. It's a flow state that we're in. I apologize for it. It was inappropriate. And you just sort of move forward. It was relatively minor, you know, what it was. But I think that's the only time, you know, in the 10 years that anyone's actually called me out, you know, afterwards, you know, for what I had said live on a microphone.
The power of a live microphone. Steve, you mentioned earlier you were an elite athlete. Walk us through some of your history. What events did you participate in? Give us a little bit more of your background.
Started as a distance runner in high school, middle distance, ran the 800, 3,000, 2,000 meter steeplechase. Sort of competed at the national level. I was top 10 in Canada a few times when I was a junior. Got into triathlon in that first early wave. So this is circa, you know, I was in high school from 75 to 80. In 1981, one of the first triathlons ever in Canada was held not too far away from Toronto. And someone had tipped me off, said, you should check this out. I was working as a lifeguard at the time. I'd always been around water. I never competed at swimming, but I was a good swimmer. And I biked a lot. I just, you know, rode a bike for, you know, for transportation as a kid, back and forth to school. And so I competed in that first triathlon in 1981. And then probably for the next 15 years, I was a triathlete. I was really lucky in that I was part of that first generation, the first wave in Canada. I'll be honest with you, Greg, we had no idea what we were doing back then. It was all a giant like experiment of like how far we could go, how fast could we go, you know, how long we could push ourselves. And then I stepped away from triathlon rather abruptly in 1997. My son was born in 1997. I was working at Segoy. I got a big promotion and I just couldn't, you know, keep doing it at the level I was. I was sort of at the national level. I'd gone to Ironman World Championships a couple of times. I competed there sort of semi-professionally. I was making a bit of money, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't making a living at it. I had jobs, you know, that I was working at full time. And then I just got back into running for a bit, and then into cycling. And now I just cycle, and cross-country skiing has also been a constant of mine. So every winter since I was a teenager, I've cross-country skied quite a bit. I've raced at cross-country skiing. I love that the fact that I have seasons. And where I live in Southern Ontario, we do get seasons. We get, you know, spring, summer, and fall. And I've, in the winter, I'm a cross country skier. In the summer, I'm a cyclist. Or, you know, years ago, I was a triathlete. So I've loved the seasonality of it. And I think that's part of my, my longevity is that you look forward to, you know, certain, you know, certain things. I don't race anymore. I don't pin a bib number on. I just ride for fun and fitness and to keep up with my amazing wife. My wife is actually the competitive one in the family. She is a 5-time Canadian women's masters road cycling champion. She's one of the top women masters road cyclists in North America. So just keeping up with her on rides is my goal every year, Greg. That's all I want to do is just, you know, keep up with her and sit on her wheel. I have no shame in doing that at all.
The power of drafting. She sounds amazing. So one last question for you, Steve. What has been your favorite moment, favorite event?
The hardest question to answer, because there is such a range, and I've touched on the massive range. Couple things. So, you know, at the more mass, you know, participation, you know, races and events, it is those moments like at the back of the pack, you know, with people coming in. I don't know what their story is. Everyone's got their own story. But there was a moment a few years ago, and this is a story I do like to share frequently, is a woman was coming in. It was a half Ironman triathlon. It was the Barrelman triathlon that's run by Multisport Canada, a longtime client of mine. And everyone had gone home. We had already done the awards. The people had finished. The park was empty. It was this woman's 3 or 4 friends and all the Multisport Canada staff and me that was left at the finish line. SportsStats was doing the timing, so by process of elimination, we knew who she was. She was, you know, coming in. She had 2K to go. She was walking, jogging. And I got all her friends up on the side of the fence, called them over. And then when she came into sight, we could see her about 200 meters off. She came into sight, and I got the mobile mic, and I went out, and I got her friends, her 3 friends, to come out around the fencing. And the five of us all ran the final 100 meters to the finish line with her, and she got across the finish line, and she gave me this big, you know, sweaty sort of, you know, bear hug, and she whispered really closely in my ear. She kind of nuzzled in my ear because I think she only wanted me to hear this. She said, "This was the best day of my life," and I said, "That's why we do this. You know, this is the moment." And I've had lots of moments like that at the tail end of races, but that kind of sums it up. For that more mass participation side. On the high performance side, I get really teary when I talk about this this athlete, this para athlete. You mentioned you interviewed a para athlete before, and I would encourage people to look this gentleman's name up. He's from Spain. His name is Ricardo Tens, T-E-N-S. He has a leg amputation and 2 arm amputations. And he races on the track. He's a track cycling specialist, like you would not believe. Mm-hmm. And to see him go, like he needs to be helped to get onto the bike, to get strapped like into the bike. And to watch Ricardo race, he races absolutely without fear. And you're thinking, my God, he's strapped into the bike. Like, how does he do this? How does he with half of one arm and no arm on the other side? How does he actually get the bike accelerating and also just below the hip sort of amputation? He was electrocuted on a high voltage line when he was a kid, and he lost those limbs. But to see him perform, Greg, he rides at a world, almost like a world class, like world tour like rider. And I get, when I've had the honor and the privilege of calling his races at the World Championships 2 times, I've announced at the para track cycling world championships 2 times. And I'm literally, by the end of his races, every time I've got tears in my eyes, you know, when he's coming across the finish line, because I've witnessed something that is defying the laws of physics and human physiology. And it is truly extraordinary. And it's truly like an honor and a privilege to be there to, you know, to call that and see Ricardo just do incredible things. Like I've never seen anything like this, and I would encourage anyone to just go and put Ricardo's name into Google. There's videos, and you'll be blown away. I promise you.
You've got the hair on the back of my neck standing up just listening to that. Steve, how can an audience member get in touch with you?
I'm still on Twitter. I was early in on Twitter or X or whatever Elon's calling it these days. That's probably the, I still love Twitter. I love the sort of the snappy, you know, political repartee that sort of goes, you know, back and forth. It still is really good for sports, like for quick, you know, hits of sports information. I follow a lot of people like in my world, in the endurance sports world, track and field, running, et cetera. So a lot of the information, the tips I get are from Twitter. And that's probably the best spot to for the public to generally reach me. And because I got in early on Twitter, it's pretty easy to find me. I'm at Steve Fleck, STEVEFLECK. On X, and reach out.
Steve, it's been amazing having you on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation around, it's about the journey, and we're talking about the elite athletes and their performance and how they recognize that race day is just a stepping stone on their longer term goals. These last two stories you shared, one of what that lady whispered to you at the finish line is, again, it's choking me up a little bit, and talking about Ricardo and his performance. You've really brought a lot of inspiration to this show today, and I thank you for that. So for my guests, my listeners, please like this show. Please share it with your community. Let's have these stories spread so that more and more people can be impacted by our conversation. Again, Steve, been great having you on the show. Thank you for your time.
Greg, it's been an amazing opportunity. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Chief Endurance Officer Podcast. To hear more inspiring stories and strategies around the endurance mindset, be sure to subscribe below or visit us at chiefenduranceofficer.com. Until next time, keep pushing those limits